Now, in Palestine, Palestine is a key spot for a Canadian foothold of this transformation. Sometimes the interventionism takes place in a situation like Afghanistan, with boots on the ground, with fighting house to house. Sometimes it takes place like it does in Haiti, with a few soldiers, a few diplomats, and a lot of money channeled through certain organizations. It's the same program, it's the same toolbox, different tools being used for different countries, but it's the same toolbox. Canadian forces don't fire a gun in Palestine, but they're the most important element in a project that fires many guns and is carrying out a brutal repressive apparatus designed through and through to overthrow a democratically elected government. And so Canada doesn't have to fire a shot for it to play the identical role as if it were. And so I'm just going to take a minute to set the scene how we came to this change in eras in Palestine as well. The first Intifada in 87 to 92 was a political protest movement that was dealt with through active warfare. And then once there's a stalemate, diplomacy. So you go from the warfighting terrain to the diplomatic terrain. It's a constant in world affairs to carry out this way. So the first Palestinian Intifada, which was probably the third or fourth actual Palestinian Intifada against the Zionist project, but it's called the First Intifada, that required Israel to take the political conflict and move it into the diplomatic arena, which we saw in the Oslo peace process, which was famously said, or should have been famously, but was nevertheless said by Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was the lead negotiator for Israel, that the efforts of the Oslo peace process were to create a system, he said, of permanent neo-colonial dependency. So from the Intifada, you have this move to the Oslo peace process to create permanent neo-colonial dependency for the Palestinians, something less than a state, but maybe, you know, with lapel pins and stamps and flags flying, but no independent foreign policy, no military, no borders, you know, no independent economy, but some sort of, you know, state minus, right? And of course, we saw that, you know, spectacularly fail in October of 2000 with the second Palestinian Intifada, which rages for 3 years. And, you know, there's not enough minutes to talk about all of these things, but it was a brutal war suppressed by Israel from the first day of the second Intifada, continued from the last day of the first Intifada. So the introduction for Israel in the first days of protests were to meet popular protests with helicopter gunships and with tanks. That was the first time Palestinians had seen helicopter gunships used against populations. And actually, if you look into the LexisNexis database, there's actually some amazing stories that came out in journals that you wouldn't expect to have stories like that, like the Edmonton Journal or Vancouver Sun or whatnot, with headlines like, Israelis deploy helicopter gunships against protests. You know, it was a wire story, something they didn't think it through. And they make these kind of headlines that within a few years were, of course, obfuscated into something like, you know, Hamas did something in the headline. And then you read on that actually, you know, 30 Palestinians died and no one even was hurt on the Israeli side. But at first, these headlines were saying that these were the first times that the helicopter gunships were used. And so that intifada rages. And as the stalemate hits in 2003, 2004, Israel is trying to again move the project back into the diplomatic arena, where it can postpone a settlement while it continues to build its state. And to do so is the real linchpin of my talk here at Apartheid Week, is a very important narrative to understand, because I'm going to take the apartheid, which is considered, you know, a provocative term, or people say, you know, well, it's about South Africa and there's, you know, things that are different. Apartheid is a core of Israel's political project. Not the provocative, if there is a non-provocative apartheid term, but apartheid is an Afrikaner word that means separation. And separation is the core of the Zionist project. And that's what you see when you see the Israelis asking Hamas to recognize a Jewish state. They're not asking them to recognize a democratic, liberal, whatever. They're asking them to represent a Jewish state in a land that is 50% Jewish, 50% Arab. And so the apartheid analogy is not provocative. It's actually the core of the conflict from the Israeli perspective. So the shift happens in the operation to create the program to create ghetto Palestine, which I admit does sound like a provocative term, but I live there, and so I live in a ghetto, even though my work in this region has shown me time and time again that the disconnect between what I witness every day on the ground and what I come back and am told is controversial is ever widening. So the reality is that I live in ghetto Bethlehem. I live in a city that's completely surrounded by an 8-meter-high concrete wall with sniper towers, with only two entrances and exits that are checkpoints. And if you were to fly over it, as I don't know if people saw Michael Ignatieff's quote that has been going around over the last little while from 2002, where he was writing in The Guardian as a Harvard professor, and he said, my friend, you know, took me for a flight, you know, he's got friends in Israel that take him on helicopter flights over the West Bank. And he said, you know, I looked down, and what I looked down at, you know, this is as a supporter of Israel, he said, what I looked down at was not the future of a state, but it was the Bantustans from South Africa. And it, again, sounds provocative, but that's exactly what it is. If you were to fly over it, if you want to break it down anecdotally in the question-answer period, it's the craziest state in the world, where you have, Palestinian ghettos and Israeli fortresses on hilltops. You have, you know, three or four different levels of citizenship within that model, and some of those levels of citizenship involve, you know, not even the use of the word citizen of any state, right? Palestinians famously, infamously, don't have passports, so they don't have the ability to travel with any kind of normal document. They travel with these crazy, plastic folders full of documents stamped by three different governments and whatnot. And this is the apartheid analogy is the core of the state. And Israel comes up with this in 2003. During Sharon's regime, and as the Intifada is waning, the suicide bombings have stopped, and Israel is trying to shift the conflict into the diplomatic arena, and it does it by floating a trial balloon through Ehud Olmert, who became prime minister in Israel, but at the time was foreign minister and held several portfolios in the strange parliamentary system that Israel has. He was Sharon's, you know, number one deputy at the time. And so rather than Sharon coming and sticking his neck out with a new plan, he got Olmert to do it and to float this plan. And he floated it in an interview in Haaretz, the leading liberal Israeli daily, and it was called, the headline of the article was with quotation marks, and it was called Maximum Jews, Minimum Arabs. Okay, and it was an interview about this new policy, which the headline alone should be enough to justify calling it Apartheid Week and moving on, right? Maximum Jews, minimum Arabs, which has been an Israeli policy all along. In fact, it's actually the left-wing Israeli policy, separation. The right wing is ethnic cleansing, and the left wing wants separation. And the left wing in Israel, which is like, I mean, as bad as Canada's left and right political spectrum is, I mean, Israel's just moved the whole chart, right? It's off the charts. I mean, the Labour government is as right-wing a government as the Harper conservatives, and it's considered the left in Israel. So he floated this trial balloon in this article, Maximum Jews, Minimum Arabs, where he says we're getting to a crisis point here in the state of Israel. He says, you know, with the failure of the Oslo peace process, the Palestinians are more and more, he says, uninterested in a two-state solution. Why? Because they see that their state is going to be a ghetto state where each city is separated from the other and connected with a tunnel or a bridge or something. And so increasingly people don't, he says, Palestinians are less and less interested in a negotiated two-state solution. And what he says, crucially, is there's a shift underway right now that we need to subvert, which is a shift away from what he calls the Algerian model of national liberation struggle, that is, you know, the natives expelling the colonial occupier. And he says there's a shift to the South African model, which is one man, one vote, civil rights struggle, effectively. And Olmert, you know, in this article, which I feel like if you were ever only going to read one thing about Israel and Palestine, read this Haaretz article from 2003, October 2003, called Maximum Jews, Minimum Arabs, and it's the whole core of the conflict, right in a nutshell. Israel is afraid of what it calls the demographic bomb, the idea that the Jewish population is going to be a minority in the land historically called Palestine. And were this to happen, This would, of course, remove the legitimacy for the state of Israel and all its international backers as the only democracy and yada yada, because everybody will plainly see that a minority is lording over a majority that, incidentally, is growing at far greater rates than the Jewish minority, which is very much a sort of Western capitalist kind of post-industrial state where they have, you know, 1.5 kids max or whatever, right? Well, the Palestinians are having very large families and keeping that community element of the large families very much in place. Even if you don't want to include the West Bank and Gaza, even if you want to just include, you know, Israel proper, the Arabs will outnumber the Jews inevitably in modern political future, you know? So you could say 100 years, but it'll be less than that. But it's not like in 23, 25 or something. Like, we're talking very soon. And this demographic crisis is, according to the Israelis, the death of the Zionist project. It's the death of their state enterprise. Because their state is not about self-determination for Jews in an area of the world where they maintain the victories of the Israeli state, the revival of Hebrew, the social and cultural revival that happened with the state of Israel. For the Israeli construction of Zionism in the 20th and 21st century, it's an exclusively, if not homogeneously, Jewish state. That is the definition of Zionism. It's not simply a binational project where you go and live in a state. You have to control that state under a certain paradigm of Zionism, which involves a racial supremacy for one group of people over the other. And I think this term is important. The Israelis aren't anti-Muslim or anti-Arab or whatnot. Their project is a supremacist project. It's not an oppressive project. In that sense, what I mean is they're trying to issue super rights, not to remove rights from another. So, for example, within Israeli documents, it doesn't say Arabs and Jews. It says Jews and non-Jews. This is a very important distinction when you see things coming up like Palestinians not being able to work anymore in Israel, and so Israel has had to go to South Asian exploitable migrant workers. But that creates the exact same problem, because these Thai workers want citizenship and they want their kids to go to school and they want to go to the hospital when they get sick. And now all of a sudden, the non-Jews, it doesn't matter if they're Thai or from Mars, they're diluting the Zionist project, which its goal is an overwhelmingly, if not homogeneously, Jewish state. In fact, they keep statistical attributes of that state, and you can see them in core planning documents, the Jerusalem planning documents that say we're going to maintain a 68-32 Jews to Arabs balance in the city, you know, in perpetuity, regardless of what happened. And so that's how you get redrawing of borders, that's how you get the settlers driving out Palestinians from their homes, is to maintain this structural apartheid, right? And even if you don't use it in a pejorative, it's a separation. And so Olmert says that that shift is the most important thing that needs to be undermined. How do we do that, he says? A number of ways. The first way, we're going to build a wall. We're going to build a wall, we're going to build it around Palestine, and we're going to withdraw, we're going to remove our settlers from the Gaza Strip, where 5,000 of them live amongst 1.5 million Palestinians. And believe it or not, when Sharon colonized Gaza, he believed that if they put enough fields or whatever, had enough organic crops, that Jews would move to Gaza and outnumber the 1 million refugees that live in the Gaza Strip, which seems at this point crazy, but that was the intention. So remove those settlers from Gaza, Israel said, wash our hands of Gaza, and get rid of 1.5 million Palestinians that are diluting the state of Israel, to get rid of the control of those people. So that's when the whole disengagement project of 2005 was part of this ghetto Palestine project. And the goal, explicitly stated, was to wall off the West Bank and create in the West Bank a series of Gaza Strips. And I live in one of them, in Bethlehem. Qalqilia was the first one in the north. There's one in the north that doesn't have concrete walls around it, has electronic fences because it's a rural area. But the fact is, the Bantustans, the ghettos, you know, we would call them reserves or reservations. Ghetto is a term from Nazi-occupied Europe. But you can pick your term, whatever term pleases you to describe to territorially separate the indigenous population from the settler population, and then give them some sort of autonomous rights. You know, I think we can probably understand that in Canada. How do you have a native population that has some sort of autonomy, but whose land we can pillage when necessary, because we don't know what the frontiers of the next economic, now our frontiers are the Inuit. We didn't care about the Inuit for 100 years, and now we're going up there, you know, and so the projects to create some sort of level of autonomy less than statehood, less than independence is the goal. And so creating this project in Palestine was something that Olmert was very, very clear about. And Dov Weisglass, who is the sort of Karl Rove to Sharon and Olmert and Sipi Livni, he called this project, the creation of the wall, the removal from Gaza, he called it the formaldehyde solution. The idea was that you take the most important elements of the Israel-Palestine conflict, Jerusalem, settlements, borders, and refugees, the four most important issues that Israel cannot solve, because solving any one of those issues undermines its project. You take those four issues and you put them in formaldehyde. So that's why he called it the formaldehyde solution. If you want to read another amazing interview that will tell you everything you need to know about Palestine, look up the interview with Dov Weisglass called the formaldehyde solution. Dov Weisglass is the one who also was the one who put formidable clarity to the siege on Gaza when he called it the diet. He said, we're going to put them on a diet. And that has worked out to be a meticulous program where they literally have algorithms for caloric intake divided by population, depending on the foods. They break all the foodstuffs into calories. They break all the populations and age brackets into demographics. And then they do an algorithm for what the caloric intake to enter into Gaza so that people are on the edge of starvation, but they're not starving. That's the goal. So, you know, we should be careful when we say things like Gazans are starving, because it does undermine the autonomy of the Gaza Strip, which is actually not starving because they took initiative on their own to open the tunnels, to make them bigger, to get proper trade through the tunnels. And the societal collective will to look after one another is vibrant in Gaza. Nobody starves to death. So we should be careful in trying to implicate Israel in starving Palestinians, undermining Palestinian autonomy and independence and political initiative by saying they're starving, because they aren't. But Dov Weisglass is the key advisor to those three, you know, Sharon, Olmert, and then Livni. I mean, she won the election, but she wasn't able to form a government. She would have been the next prime minister. Kadima has more seats in the Knesset than Netanyahu does, but he was able to form a coalition with the right-wing religious parties that, if people here knew what they stood for, what they said, what they believed, what they did on the streets, it's a religious fundamentalism that's not any different than a Taliban type of fundamentalist approach to religion. I mean, in the settlements, you know, they have men and women swimming pools, and women have to be separated during, you know, the whole deal. It's all there. You know, they'll stone protest demonstrations. They'll throw eggs or rotten fruit at women that are riding by on their bicycles if they don't have full length. The kind of things that if the Palestinians did, there would be like the Security Council would meet about it. These parties are representative in this way, and therefore Netanyahu was able to form a government. But Weisglass is really the sort of the advisor behind these people that is the most. So he called it the diet. He called it the formaldehyde solution. And he said, because after Sharon called for the disengagement, these right-wing people that I just described, these fundamentalists, actually issued a Jewish fatwa, or whatever you call it, to say, you know, God was going to strike down Sharon for giving up any piece of the land of Palestine, or, you know, the land of Eretz Israel in this disengagement. And Weisglass, in this interview, confronts that idea and says, I don't understand why these settlers are upset. The settlers, he said, should be dancing around Sharon's office because of this plan, the plan to create ghettos, which will leave, he said, 90% of the settlers in place. So this removal from Gaza, which wasn't a withdrawal — withdrawal is a military term and a political term with consequences that were not reached in Gaza. Gaza is still held by Israel in what is called belligerent occupation, and that's renewed by the Israeli High Court every year, that they hold Gaza in belligerent occupation. What they did was they removed the settlers, and they moved the bases of the army from inside Gaza to the border. So now, if you were to drive up to Gaza, which you can't do because the military is all around the border and they won't let people come close, but were you to do that, you would see the Gaza Strip completely encircled with the sea on one side with warships off it, drones flying around it, and all along the border, military bases, right? Like if we think, we only know one prisoner, right? We know Gilad Shalit. He was taken prisoner. How was he taken prisoner? They dug a tunnel underneath the wall, and the military base was so close to the wall that they could dig a tunnel under and come up to the base, grab Shalit, and bring him, okay? That just gives you an idea of where the bases are. The bases are all around the Gaza Strip. So when we see rocket fire coming out of Gaza, and we're saying, oh, they're firing it at some kindergarten or a nursing home or something, right? They're firing it at military bases that are all around the Gaza Strip. Thousands, tens of thousands of soldiers, pieces of artillery, tanks, all amassed along the border of Gaza. If you were to fly over, it would look like a military siege in proper terms. And so that's why when we use some of these terms in Palestine, like apartheid, like ghetto, like siege, these terms are not provocative terms. They're core dictionary definition, political definitions of what is happening.